Coming up on today's show, we have Tom from Race Day Prints, a company which will take your Strava, run, cycle, bike, exercise information and turn that into a beautifully crafted printout for your wall to display proudly in your home your most recent and or biggest ever accomplishment to date. That could be a marathon, that could be a long bike ride, whatever it might be. You can present it for the world to see with your Strava data, which I think is a fantastic idea. He's previously sold a business with custom sliders where he managed to negotiate with a Chinese supplier on low MOQs to actually do the personalization for him and get them shipped over here personalized, ready to go. So we talk about that, but perhaps this episode is a good one if you are a new founder questioning whether you should get into e-commerce, especially in this climate. And I say that because Tom certainly wouldn't profess to be an expert in all things e-commerce and D2C, but he is someone who is disciplined, who has a strong will to succeed and puts the time and effort in to trying something that he thinks could be cool or could work as a business. And he's been successful at it. A lot of us might look at that first business, the slider business, the personalization, and think, it's going to be difficult and maybe I'm going to look at something else. But he thought, you know what, I think it's a good idea. He actually managed to sell that business and now he's on to another venture. We do talk about that, but we also talk about some other deeper meaning things like exercise, the search for meaning. There's quite a lot in this episode, to be honest, mainly stacked towards the end. We talk about, you know, just really health, mental health and being a founder and some of the things you can do to remain top of your game from a body and mind perspective. It's a fun episode. It's a relaxing episode. We don't get too deep into any particular D2C e-commerce topics, but we do discuss the general to's and fro's of being in business and also exercising and maintaining a healthy lifestyle. So do check it out. Sponsored as always by Sendlane and by Rewind. Sendlane, SMS, emails and reviews. Great team, great product. Something that most stores are switching over to from things like Klaviyo. If you're still using Klaviyo and paying quite a lot of money for it, a lot of people are. Sendlane is a great option and they have some incredible things to talk to you about and show you, so please do book in a demo. And Rewind is the app that should be on your Shopify store if you care about your product data, your customers, your order data, and essentially just having a store that is always going to be protected and backed up. That's what Rewind offers, as well as some good business practices like a development site where you can test all of your changes, install new apps, do lots of different things that you might do without doing on your live site, so that your live site is always in a safe little bubble, always operational, always taking orders without you messing around with it or your team. So do check Rewind out again. You can just go onto the App Store and look for Rewind and go on Google and search for Sendlane. On to today's episode with Tom. Tom, welcome to the Ecom Gold Podcast. How are you doing, sir?
Mate, thanks for having me. This is the first podcast I've ever done. So looking forward to this.
Podcast virginity taken again. Yeah. I've got a few notches on my bedpost. I'll add you to it. Sounds a bit.
I've never done one.
Oh well, look, they're good fun. They're good fun. Anyway, we connected. You were on the way back from France, having just put some miles into those legs. So tell us a bit about what you were doing over there.
Yeah, me and I've got a few mates who were all a bit of loose cannons, and last minute, one of the boys went, "Should we go trail running in Chamonix?" So we blasted down to Chamonix, drove down on a Wednesday afternoon, straight out of the car, ran up a mountain, and then continued to run up mountains for the following 3 days. Got back yesterday. And now I'm in a gloomy London. There's no Alps in sight, sadly.
Give us the stats, the numbers on the doors, scores on the doors, how many miles done, elevation, what are we talking?
We clocked in about 65 kilometers over 4 days, averaged a half marathon a day with 1700 meters of elevation. It was good. We got up to about 4000 meters on the highest day, a lot more snow than we were expecting.
Snow.
Yeah, a lot more. Snow level was about sort of 2300 meters. And from there up, it was just full-on winter.
That's insane. That is insane. I didn't realize that you were running through snow as well. I thought it would at least just be sort of loose gravel and things like that.
Yeah, it was a lot more.
What is it?
Say again?
How much more difficult is it running through snow?
Well, a lot more. It got very deep up. So it's about, at this time of year, it's about 2,300, 2,400 meters is the snow level. And then obviously the higher you go, the more there is. And one day we crossed over a ridge and the wind had obviously been backing all the snow up and just blowing it. So there was a few times where we were like 4 feet deep in snow and it was way more than we were expecting.
Yeah, that's outrageous. Why is it such a popular place? I had a friend of mine, ultra runner, and he goes there. What is it about that place that attracts you kind of lunatics?
Have you heard of UTMB? The like big crazy, it's a massive race. It happens in the summer from Chamonix. I don't know what the distance is. It's like 170 kilometers or something. That could be completely wrong, but it's some crazy long distance. But with Chamonix, it's, have you been there before?
No, I've not.
It's basically the town is in the valley, and either side of the valley are just huge, huge mountains. You've got Mont Blanc on one side and more on the other side. So it's quite well set up for that sort of thing. You can just literally leave the town and within minutes you're up into the mountains. So it's very much sort of set up for it, I think.
Yeah, unreal. So talk us through your kit, because this is an area that I'm loving at the moment, which is these kind of underground niche run brands that are now becoming kind of mainstream. We're seeing it quite a lot in sports. I'm not sure if you're paying attention a lot,
yeah.
But in sports specifically, there's this kind of subculture fashion forward brand emergence. Like we've got Satisfy Running, you've got just a few of those kind of brands, aren't they, knocking around? What clobber do you wear?
There's a lot of trendy like little brands coming out now, isn't there? And to be honest, I'm the worst guy for it. I'll just whack on any old kit and go for it. Most of my kit's off of like Depop or something. I've got one of my tops is a Terex, one of the Adidas Terex ones, and I love that. I just bought a pair of Brooks trail shoes. I'd never worn Brooks before, and they were fantastic in the sort of loose trails. Got a bit bad up in the snow because not really what they're built for. But yeah, I've seen a lot of this stuff. But running's so huge now, isn't it? All these brands are popping up, and all the run clubs and this stuff, which is good to see, to be fair.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The surgence of running, and I think it's affecting the younger generations as well, specifically the people I follow. When I was that sort of age, I was not running. I was doing other things, you know, going out in the town or whatever. But they're more focused on the Pamir Saturday park run than they are on a Friday night binge. So all good stuff, I imagine. All good stuff.
It's a massive shift happening, it feels like, at the moment anyway. Especially also in London here, is I think there is a shift from people sort of going out on the booze, and there's more now they're enjoying their weekends and doing sort of exercise, really getting up fresh the Saturday morning and going and smashing out a bike or something.
I'm here for it. I love it. There's like all that, like Uvu as well, that little brand that's popped up,
and yeah,
just some amazing, really amazing brands. I wonder if that's happening around the world. Listeners around the world, maybe fill us in if this is something you're seeing too, but definitely in London. Sorry for the odd sound effects going on. It's dinner time here in Indonesia.
I think it is happening more so, but especially here in London, I've noticed it. I think also it was after COVID. It was obviously all the gyms and everything shut, so everyone was like, oh, I've got to go for a run now, which is good, to be fair. And there are run clubs popping up everywhere. I've always been doing it, so nothing really changed for me. But there's, loads of little trendy brands.
So talk to us a bit about your background then. Just give us an overview of personally and professionally, what makes you you? What's built the person that I see today in front of me over the years?
It's a good question, that. Me and my brother have this chat often, because we're always like, why are we so weird? Like, we're not doing things that a lot of people are doing. I think what got us, so my brother's the same as me. I don't know why we got into startup world. That's a bit of an anomaly. We'll get onto that. But so my dad was a 3-time Olympian, Olympic rower.
Wow.
So for GB. So he did, what did he do? Barcelona, Seoul and Los Angeles Olympics. So from a young age, me and my brother were always down by the river, always doing exercise, even through the winter when it was cold and horrible. So it's just been the norm for us. I was then playing rugby. I never actually rowed. I should have rowed in hindsight. I was always playing rugby. Then got big into CrossFit. Loved CrossFit just because it's so demanding in many different ways. Loved that. Then when all the gyms shut because of COVID, I then picked up running and biking more so, which is now what I'm doing more at the moment. Done a few ultra marathons off the back of that. Done a half Ironman. I've got a full Ironman booked next year. So yeah, just smashing out all the miles on that. And then in terms of business wise, so me and my brother, we sold custom sliders. It was called Slide Tribe. Founded this in 2018.
In the shoes, right? As in flip flop type things.
Yeah, like flip flops. So it was custom sliders, and it was initially started off the back of, because we were always by the river, people in rowing boats, the shoes are attached to the boat. So you walk down to the boat in always like a skanky pair of trainers or flip flops or whatever. And I just thought it would be cool if everyone's footwear matched, like matched the rest of their kit. And I also thought, you know, if I was at university and then someone came to me and said, do you want a pair of sliders with your club logo on and your initials for 20 quid? Would you want it? And I'd be like, yeah. So that was how that started. So we started selling to sports clubs, universities, quickly went more so into B2B, doing some bigger orders. We sold to like Red Bull, Google, Harlequins, some quite big names. And then we did that for 4.5 years and sold that.
Wow.
August last year.
Oh, amazing.
I don't know why. Sorry, go on.
Just gonna say, how did you scale that up? Because presumably you started by just ordering some slider blanks and getting them printed up or something. What was the kind of journey, as because that's a 4-year business slinging sliders to corporates and things like that? There must have been some maturity and some building out of that business. So, like, can you just give us a bit of a picture of how it started and then what it looked like when you sold it?
The hardest thing initially was finding a supplier, because we'd approached loads of suppliers in China and their minimum orders were all like 100 plus. And for us selling to like your Saturday football team, we needed minimum orders of sort of 20 to 30. So for ages, that was a huge hurdle. Eventually, we found them. We found one supplier. We used them for a bit. Wasn't too happy with it. Changed to a new supplier and used them ever since for the whole time. But China nowadays, I think, are realizing that it's worth their time to do smaller orders to the West, because there's just more to be done, I think. So we did that. And then gradually, yeah, just scaled it from doing the university teams, quickly realizing, well, we got a few inquiries from B2Bs, and then realized we may as well push B2B because it's the same workload for us, but the quantities are larger. So then started doing that. And then from there, we just, yeah, churned it really.
And how did you actually start advertising and marketing to these B2B firms? Because that's a bit different from what most people would be used to. Was it more Google AdWords? How did you actually get your foot in the door with them?
We had a few inquiries just come in organically, and then we started then reaching out to sort of companies that would supply kit or like merchandise, promotional merchandise into the big companies. That was the best way usually. So say, for example, NatWest were doing some sort of corporate show and they needed like 300 pairs of slides and 300 keyrings or something. That was usually the way we'd do that. But in terms of sort of the D2C stuff, we were doing Facebook ads, Google ads. Facebook ads were really good for us because this was back before Facebook decided to change everything and ruin it. So that was really good for us.
Unreal. And then you got out of that game. Why did you decide to leave at that time? What was the reasoning behind that?
It was just the time for a change, really. We'd done it for 4 years. We'd also founded it without a clue really what we were doing. We were just winging it, the whole thing. And we felt like we got to a point where to scale it, we'd have to employ people, which I didn't want to do. It's just sort of that. And it just felt like it was the right time, really, just to give it on to someone with more experience, I guess. Just time for a change.
And did you have an idea when you walked away from that what you wanted to do next? Were you already kind of scheming on your next idea? Did you go and work for someone? Like, what was your elevation from that?
Had no plan at all. Basically, me and my brother just spent the next 5-6 months going on a few holidays and chilling out. Because we hadn't had any time off in 4.5 years. It was only him and I. So we employed no people, no freelancers. So we had to be switched on the whole time. And it was full on. Even at sort of Christmas, you couldn't really switch off. You had to be dealing with a box of sliders that's lost at a border or something, because we had to ship them in from China. And then dealing with things like COVID and the world stopping, and then Brexit. It was tough. It was good fun. I learned a hell of a lot.
What were some of the key takeaways for you then? You mentioned there, like, things like boxes going missing and things like that. But what would you say some of the most unexpected but kind of draining parts of running an e-commerce business like that were for you?
I guess, you couldn't switch off. If you've got a team of people and you can delegate a bit, then yeah. But it was just him and I and my brother. So that was one of the hardest bits, is just being on the whole time. But it did... Over the years, we did sort of streamline it more and more and get things working a bit more fluently in the early days of it. So we basically, with the orders of sliders, we would have the club logo on, or the team logo, and China would print that. But then we wanted to put everyone's initials on the sliders, and China wouldn't do that, because if say we had a pair of sliders with my initials on and a pair with yours on, technically it's a different design. So they wouldn't do that. So we had to put the initials on here. So me and my brother, we'd have an iron and get some of that, like, paper and iron on the initials onto each pair. So we were sitting, like, in our grand shed, like, over COVID, just us, like, ironing sliders. until it got to the point where we said to China, look, we're wasting so much time here. You need to take this on. And a bit of back and forth thing, and they took it on, which that saved a hell of a lot of time.
Well, it's amazing that you managed to get them to do that. I also love that you refer to them as just China, like you're dealing with the whole of China, or possibly even the government. But it's
China are amazing. They'll just do anything.
It's quite incredible that you managed to get that out of them, to be honest, because personalization at that level, especially for individual units, it's just unheard of from a low MOQ factory or something like that. But at the same time, I can see why you might be anxious to scale a business where you're the person having to iron on the initials. You know, it's almost
that's
like scale it and I'm just giving myself more work that I don't enjoy.
We couldn't really take anything on. We couldn't grow it because we were so busy. And also at the time, we did this all through COVID. So we couldn't then employ anyone because we couldn't get anyone to come and work with us, because it would have been mixing households and all that rubbish. So we said to China, like, you have to take this on because we can't grow here. And we're wasting so much time and energy ironing sliders that they took it on.
That's amazing. Well done for getting that negotiation done. So at that point, were you ordering quite a lot? Did you have a bit of a kind of sway with them?
We were growing and growing. And then during COVID, it must have been about April of 2020, where everyone was at home. Everyone was sat on their phones buying stuff. The sun was out in the UK. So everyone was really sort of happy. Oh, we'll be out of this lockdown in 3 weeks. Everyone was buying. So Facebook ads were dirt cheap. And we were so busy. We were flat out. We did sort of four or five months of doing sort of 30K revenue each. And we were just sat in our grand shed, like, ironing sliders.
That's crazy.
It's mad. So we were doing good quantities. I don't know what quantities we were doing. Probably a good few thousand pairs a month. So it was worth China's while to take it on.
Yeah, makes sense. So Looking back on it now, you've had a bit of time to reflect, presumably, on that time that you had. Yeah. Would you have changed anything? Would you have done anything differently, do you think?
I don't think I would, because, as I said, it was totally new to us. We were just completely winging it every day. And I think it went really well. The one thing maybe I would have done would have been sold it a bit earlier during those months when revenue was way higher. But at hindsight, you'd never know. I don't think I would have changed it. It was, we were just sort of ticking along and getting it done. But as I said earlier, like, I don't know why my brother and I got into the whole sort of e-com startup world, because like no one in my family has ever run their own business. My dad's a teacher, mum works at schools as well. So I don't know how. It was basically just I had the idea, thought that would work, let's try it. So that was really it.
I think that's how a lot of it happens. And then a lot of it's up to hard work, luck and persistence, really, from there. So yeah. I see that you've also now looked at maybe doing a different venture, one that caught my eye. And actually the reason why I reached out to you initially, because I really love the concept of it. I don't think it's a new concept, but I do like what you're doing with it. So just talk us through where your head's pointed at the moment.
So after selling SlideTribe, had some time off, and then I kind of missed the sort of hustle and bustle of just having a little project to work on. One of the big realizations from SlideTribe was you can just create revenue out of nothing, almost. You can just, if you put everything together, make a little website, have a good project, good product, it should sell. And you can sell anything to anyone if you put it in front of the right people. So that was one of the big realizations. So missed the hustle and bustle. Then my brother started working on Race Day Prints, which basically we get someone's, typically Strava, sort of their run, their bike, if they've done a big marathon or something like that, and we can put it onto a printout and they can stick it on the wall so they can memorize that day. My brother's done most of the whole techie stuff. I'm like an ape when it comes to computers. So we're working on that at the moment. That's still pretty new. We're sort of growing that. But it all seems a bit harder now. I think after Facebook changed bits and bobs on their end and changed the ads and that sort of stuff, it does feel like things are more tricky to get things off the ground now as opposed to when we started 5-6 years ago now. So it's a bit of a slow burn of that. I've also got another one that I don't think I've told you about. It's called the Keyring Garage, and it's custom keyrings of like famous cars. So got that going. That's a slow burner as well. But I think I just like having a project, really.
I imported a bulk import of products into Shopify, and I did not put in the meta fields the created date, and that sent the whole filtering system haywire because you could no longer filter collections by newest in first or date added to the website, which was a really big problem for this quite large fashion brand. If I didn't have Rewind, that would have been a complete pickle. It would have taken hours, if not days, to sort out all of the while these products are live and really messing up their merchandising. A mistake by me, absolutely, but fortunately I had the foresight to install Rewind before I made any of these changes, and I was able to just click a button, restore the site back to a previous version just a few minutes before I made that fatal error, and no one was any the wiser. That's the value of Rewind. That's just one use case, okay? One use case. There are hundreds of other use cases. Have it on there, because when you need it, you'll text me or you'll tweet me and say, thank you so much, Finn, for recommending that I install Rewind. You saved my bacon. Back to today's show.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. The e-commerce landscape has shifted slightly. There's a few more headwinds, especially right now. But at the same time, there are always opportunities, I think. And it's how you approach it and what you do. So what have you done differently this time around? How has your head been different coming into these projects? Do you feel like you're a bit more mature, taking some of the learnings from that first?
Yeah, I feel more experienced now, obviously, because we've done it for 5 years, and it's knowing bits and bobs that at the time of doing SlideTribe didn't know at all because it was completely new. So now it's like okay, we need this done, let's use that, we need that done, let's use that. So it's much more easier now to do things a second and third time. The thing also with SlideTribe was it was a very clunky, business model, but it wasn't a go onto a website, click buy, because it was a very custom back and forth. The customer sends us a logo, we'll then go back with a mock-up. So it wasn't straightforward. Whereas my brother and I, we wanted something where it is way more straightforward in terms of you can go onto a website and click buy, just to make things easier and a bit more scalable. So that was kind of the motive for Race Day Prints and the Keyring Garage. Just to make things easier.
Yeah, and I understand why you do Race Day Prints. I don't understand why you do the, because that's obviously part of what you do. You like running. It's one of your passions, obviously. And that seems to marry up quite well. But why the key rings? Why did you think that was a good idea?
I used to work in the supercar game back in the day. I worked for a small company, and we were brokering and sourcing cars for people. And selling cars with people, finding cars, and everything from sort of Ferraris to Bentleys and stuff. So I liked cars. And I've had a few Land Rover Defenders over the years, and I had a green one, and I bought a little keyring to match the car. So that was the motive for that. And I was just like, if I want a keyring to match my car, or if I want a keyring of my favorite car, then surely someone else does. So that was the motive for that. And I just sort of thought that because I'm the audience, that should work. So that was really the reason for that. Just very simple.
Sounds like it would do quite well on something like TikTok. Did you venture that way, or are you stuck with Facebook?
I haven't done TikTok at all. I've been so anti TikTok ever since it came out, and I know I should go on it. I should get someone else to do it for me. I have this weird thing with social media. Like, on one hand, I absolutely loathe social media and think it is just terrible for humanity. But on the flip side, I know how powerful it is. So I kind of force myself to do social media.
But what about running ads? Are you running ads at all?
No, currently not. That Keyring one, I've just got on the back burner. But for Race Day Prints, we will get onto TikTok ads. We're trialing now just Facebook ads, see how it goes. Got a few orders in whilst we were in Sham. So, yeah, just early days on those.
So what do you think, I mean, with these Facebook ads, how do you do creative? Have you only been thinking about how you do creative for Race Day Prints? Because do you just show a race print? What do you think would work best to actually sell that product to someone like you?
This is a good question, because with the sliders we were selling, we were very product heavy, because it was a very visual product. You put it in front of someone and they could see what it was. Whereas this, with the Race Day Prints, we're trying to sort of make it much less product and much more brand buildy. So people can relate to it a bit more by sort of advertising, maybe running videos, cycling videos, running through the Alps, whatever. So it's people can sort of relate to it more, and then doing a few odd sort of stills of a picture on the wall kind of thing, so people can relate to it being on the wall. It's all just a game of trialing different creatives and seeing what works. Because seemingly, you know, one week it'll be really good, the next week it won't be. And it just changes all so fast nowadays, from my experience.
Yeah, that's right. And what do you think about people? I mean, how do you elevate beyond what essentially, as you said, like Strava, which I don't know a lot about, but I know it's an app where you record your runs, things like that. You have access to that data. And I imagine there's probably a button that allows you to print it onto a piece of A4 paper and stick it in a frame. Now, most people probably won't do that. But how have you elevated the product beyond that point, or how do you plan to elevate the product beyond just someone printing it off of Strava?
I don't know if you can. There's not, from my experience, I've used Strava for ages, and there's no obvious way that you could screenshot it and then stick it onto like a Word doc and print it, I think. But you couldn't just, there's no print button. The motive was more so that, say you go and do your first London marathon, it's a huge achievement for you, and you've got your Strava map there, but then, you know, it's lost on your phone for ages. You go do a few more runs on Strava, it's gone. So it was more so just trying to capture memories for people that they've worked, you know, weeks, months, years for that one day. And if you can get that onto your wall, somebody would like that. I'd buy that.
Yeah, without a doubt. I've seen similar things, and I think it's a brilliant keepsake. And what I was trying to work out was, is there a way that you can refine the design of it and bring kind of a flair to that design that's unique and memorable to your brand that helps you kind of elevate your price point potentially, but also, you know, making it more desirable in something that you can offer a consumer to say, this is what you did and look how pretty we've made it. It might not be pretty, but do you know what I mean? Are you approaching it in a way?
Yeah, we're trying at the moment to make it as smooth as possible, because at the moment you have to go onto the site to then go back off of our site to go to Strava to copy the link. So we're thinking now we might pivot towards, say, the London Marathon. We have just a cassette map on our website. There's the map. All you've got to do now is punch in your numbers, your like the time, the splits, whatever, to make that way more streamlined. Because currently it's a little clunky, but it's still early days on it. So it's always going to have teething problems straight away. And it's just a game of trying one thing, seeing if it works, looking why that doesn't work, see if we can streamline that, just tweak bits and bobs here and there.
Yeah, smart. So you've got your product now. You've chosen another product with some difficulties, which is how do you ship something like that?
So we've got it hooked up to Printful. So at the moment, it's not fully hooked up yet, but now it'll be Printful will fulfill the order sent straight to them. So that's fairly straightforward. We're having a little bit of a teething problem just trying to make it all work together. But yeah, at the moment it's someone goes onto the website, buys it, Printful fulfill the order, and it gets sent out. So that's fairly straightforward.
Excellent. All right. And what's your go-to-market strategy with it? Have you looked at, you obviously, are you part of a run club yourself? Are you part of any social media groups, any WhatsApp groups?
No, I've just sort of, I'm a bit of a lone wolf and just crack on with it myself, really. But I've got loads of mates who are in run clubs, and the main go-to-market strategy now is we're thinking of pushing more to event organizers. So if there's an event organizer who's they host a half marathon, we're looking to go to them to be like, here's our product. Do you want to offer it out to your participants for a rev share? Almost, that's the plan.
Yeah, that's smart. I mean, it sounds like that's been your kind of pattern all the way through this, even with the slider company as well, because you went straight to kind of a, not a middleman, but you weren't selling D2C, where you were selling kind of through a wholesaler, if you like. In this case, it's just an event.
If you can leverage someone who has a platform and a customer base already, that's, to me, is the obvious way to go, rather than just trying to battle it out yourself, which would work, but it'll take longer. Just commit to working with someone who's got an audience or participants and say, let's build this. That's, for me, is the obvious route.
And how big do you think that can get? I love what you said there about them already having an audience, because of course they do, and that they have those audiences details, and you know quite a lot about that audience, you know, by the type of event they've entered, what personality type they might have. A Tough Mudder is going to be different to an ultra. And how, therefore, how to position your product. So, I mean, how big do you think it can get through these sorts of, is there a lot of events going on in the UK globally? Yeah.
There's stacks nowadays. It's huge, and there's more and more popping up. We've got a list now of hundreds of these events organizers, and there's so many more popping up, especially here in the UK. But I think also with social media just getting bigger and bigger, more and more people are just doing events and things and seeing others do it, and they want to do it. So there's, yeah, millions of these companies that they organize half marathons, triathlons, Tough Mudders, all this sort of stuff. There's loads of them.
So how do you find them? What's your, I mean, to you, it probably feels like obvious simplicity that you just bash it into Google and write a list, or how is that as simple as it is? And what are we talking in terms of like man hours? What sort of time are you putting in?
Literally, it's, as simple as that, just trawling through the internet, just looking for companies that host half marathons, or we'll trawl through Instagram and put in, you know, Brighton Marathon and look for events like that. And just, yeah, there's loads of them. Just trawl through Google, the internet, just Instagram, TikTok. And in terms of hours, it's just how many hours can we put into it around other commitments, really, until we can sort of grow it to a point where it should just start to run itself. We're nowhere near that yet. But that will be the strategy. Just have an odd hour or two for now, do a load of reach out until we can get to the point where we've got a good few event organizers hooked up, that it should then just start to bring in some revenue, really.
And is there a particular title that you go for when you're targeting these events? Is it like event organizer? Is there a particular person that you found that's actually, oh, they're quite good? They usually respond.
Usually it's the people who work in the sort of front-facing roles. So your marketing content roles, who they know what their participants want. They know they might work with other companies who work with them. So they know that if this product probably would be a decent fit for their customer base. But it's just either just blasting out through people's hello at emails on their website, or, you know, attacking through LinkedIn, multiple ways, really, just as, however you can get through to people. That's always the hard bit.
What sort of percentage would you put your success rate up to? Sort of 1%, 10%, 5%?
At the moment, we've not really done a whole lot just yet. We're still trying to just smooth it all out. But I think it'll be, once we can get a good few on there, it should then be, we'll go with the strategy of, your competitor has, we're working with your competitor, you should probably work with us as well. And it's within their interest as well, because we'll probably do the revenue share route. So for them, it's no extra work. They just have to promote it, and then they'll get some cash from it.
And how do you think they ultimately promote it? Do you see this going out like an email blast to their list, or how do they actually go about contacting?
That's what we'd like to go through. We'd like to get it on the email list, so that when say they've completed their whatever marathon, then they'll get an email through saying, would you like to buy da da da? Maybe some in-person leaflets and stuff on the day, just to sort of hit them again. But yeah, I think email, bit of social media as well, we're partnered with. It's all a bit of a learning curve currently.
It's quite a good idea, isn't it, actually? I quite like that idea of just turning up to these events with a stack full of flyers, giving them out to the friends and family, you know, and just be like, you know, your loved one in the race.
I think a lot of companies sort of think, oh, paper's like dead nowadays, where if you can go put something physical in people's hands, like with the slider business, we did a few pop-ups at rowing regattas and that sort of thing. And whilst we couldn't really take orders on the day because of the custom nature, it was really good just for brand building and just showing people a physical product.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you are going to a place and a space where it's your exact target market in the moment.
Exactly.
That you'd want to reach them. I can't actually think of a better strategy than doing something like that, because you could give the information to their friends and family that are watching, but also at the end of the race, I actually always, one of the best places that I ever put a flyer was in the men and women's toilets all along Brighton seafront. And that was back in one of my very early businesses. We got so much business from those specific flyers.
What was that business?
It was actually bar crawls. I was very young at the time and set up a semi-legal, it's better than saying illegal, bar crawl business in Brighton. And yes, the flyers worked a tremendous treat. We used to run into bars all across and the seafront, and in Brighton in the summer, people were drinking from about 10 a.m. all along the seafront. And we used to just slam these flyers, bar crawl tonight, text this number all over the toilets, and then the bouncers would take them down, we'd go and put them back up, but the phone didn't stop ringing.
Yeah, I bet that absolutely cleared up.
Well, it's the same as what we're talking about here, right people in the right space in the right moment. And it was just, you know, off the chain, and ultimately that's what Facebook tries to do for you. But like you said, I mean, it's a bit basic, but it's there, you know, there for the take. How many people went to the London Marathon? It's thousands, right?
Oh, like, yeah. I think last year there was 50,000, was it competitors, maybe? It's hundreds of thousands that enter. I mean, I enter every year and I don't get a spot because there's so many people.
You know what you should enter? Well, if you do get in this year, you should wear a flyer suit. Just a suit covered in your flyers with tearaways. We're like 20% off vouchers.
Yeah.
Well, people run in to grab them off you and get 20% off. That'd be brilliant. It'd be very fun.
Yeah, there's so many events now and huge marathons and Ironmans, and there's millions of them.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of money to be made in businesses that aren't necessarily your traditional sexy D2C, like an Uvu or like a Satisfy Running, or, you know, it's sexy and it's lovely and it's all polished and beautiful and exciting. But, you know, ultimately it's a lot of graft. You're selling against some really tough competitors, where I like the way that you're going. You're going with a product that you know people will like, or you hope people will like. And then you're looking at alternative ways to get that in people's hands, like you said, like you did with the sliders and possibly with this too, through events and other things like that. Seems like a smart move to me. So where do you think, I mean, have you done a bit of a SWOT analysis? What do you think the biggest threat to this business is? And if it doesn't do well, what would you do next?
I think for now, the first hurdle is just making it so smooth and streamlined on the website that it's idiot-proof almost, because that was the thing with the sliders initially. There was so much back and forth that we were like, that was one of the takeaways. We just wanted this, whatever we did next, to be so simple that it's just idiot proof. I don't know what would stop it. There's a few other competitors doing similar things, but there's enough business for everyone. So I don't think anything would really stop it. It's just a case of how quickly can we build it to sort of get it out there and try and take top spot almost.
And what about shiny object syndrome for you? Are you still, is your brain still going? You still thinking about other things, or are you just quite happy committing and trying to build something?
I've never really had shiny object syndrome. I'm very happy with very little. I think for me, it was just, I like having a product and a project to work on and seeing an idea come to fruition almost. If you like have an idea and then you gradually build that idea until you get the first bit of revenue, it's so satisfying. There's nothing more satisfying than that. And whatever that niche or idea is. I've always just, I mean, with the sliders, it was just, here's an idea I think would work. Let's try it. Because a good business, all it is just you're solving a problem, really. It's just a solution.
You are in the D2C space. If you have a brand that's selling online and you haven't at least had a demo with Sendlane, then one of two things is objectively true about you. You like setting money on fire. You like making your life more difficult. If neither of those things are true and you are an e-commerce brand and you are selling online, you do send emails, you do send SMS, you do have reviews, or at least like to collect reviews, then there is no reason for you not to at least have had a demonstration with Sendlane. They are built for e-commerce. They are the most modern platform with the best features, in my opinion, at the lowest cost. I mean, I'm not really sure what would be holding you back. Please go and check them out. Show notes below, they have an event coming up. You can still get tickets, I believe, for that event in San Diego. A link to the Commerce Roundtable in the show notes below as well. Please do go and check out Sendlane if you haven't already. Back to the episode.
I agree. Let's round this off. I want to hear a bit more about your nutrition and your training, because it sounds like you've done quite a lot in quite a short space of time. You're running ultras and you're entering these crazy races, and it doesn't sound like you've been running all that long. So what drives you? What drives you to keep running and keep challenging yourself first and foremost?
I mean, I just love feeling good 24/7. Like, for me, having a good routine, getting up at the crack of dawn, doing everything the same, I just function so much better. If I eat really well, if I train well, if I get good sleep, everything comes together and falls into the place. So since from a young age, I've been good on diet and exercise because of probably what my dad was doing. But over the past maybe 5 or 6 years, I've really sort of become super disciplined. Probably a bit too disciplined for a lot of people, but that's what I enjoy. Like I get my sort of kicks from being productive. So if I can maximize being productive, then I'm happier. So I quit alcohol as well. I sacked alcohol in because it there's no upside to it. It could be fun for 2 hours, but then I feel bad the next day and I then feel unhappy because I'm not being productive. So I'm really hot on nutrition, sleep. It really interests me as well. I love all that sort of stuff. So for me, it's just keep to a routine, feel great.
Does that bleed over into your business acumen as well? Are you the same in business?
Yeah, for sure. I think if you're disciplined, nothing can really faze you. If you're disciplined, you're sort of free almost. And any problem that comes your way in the business, you've got the sort of like backbone to deal with it, because you've like, I always say to my brother, let's go and do hard shit on the weekend, because then if we do hard shit, whatever's in the week is easy. And that's the same with getting up at, like, I hate the crowd that preach getting up at 5 a.m. Like, I hate that crowd. But for me, it is like the tone setter. And if you can get up and do a run in the rain and the dark at 5 a.m., then whatever comes at you in the day is easy.
Yeah, I think they call that suffering.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, there was an interesting thing that interests me. I'll share it now because I'm of the same mentality or as you, but less disciplined, I would say. But, you know, a lot of the same things, a lot of things you said I resonate with. And then I resonated with this too, because there's this ice bath trend as well that's going around at the moment. It's having its moment. And it's something to do with having a need to be able to control your own suffering. And by feeling like you have that control, you feel like, as you said, nothing, no hard shit can come your way. And there's some interesting reading to be done into breaking down that mentality, because for a long time, that was my mentality. It still is my mentality to some degree. But it goes deeper than that. And that's all that I'll say, at least for me, it does. And I was like, oh, that's super interesting that I felt the need to control it. Cause you've got characters like Goggins and people like that who, are just, insane and that's great. And that's who they are as a person. It's an interesting mentality. I think a lot of people have, you see it a lot in entrepreneurs as well. Do you think it's healthy?
I think it is healthy, but there is a line. Like Goggins is like, he's absolutely mental and I'm no way near Goggins level. And I think for the right person in the right environment, the right setup, it's fine. But like for me now, if I was to go full Goggins mode here, I'd have no mates. I'd do no socializing. I'd do none of that sort of stuff. So there is a line between being disciplined and being strict and still being like a functioning human in society.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things I've often contemplated, which is, and the same with business and entrepreneurship as well, you know, these people doing 100-hour weeks and things like that, is you can be addicted to anything. You can be addicted to anything. Drugs, bad. You know, addicted to alcohol, terrible. Smoking, awful. Exercise, fine, healthy. But it's, in some ways, when it's an addiction, work. You know, 100-hour weeks, that's some kind of accolade that people wear around their necks on a big medal. You know, okay, but it's an addiction. You're addicted to work. Is that still healthy or is it not? I mean, in the context that you ask that question, you have to also be able to ask it of yourself, even if what you're doing may deemed by most, especially exercise, to be healthy. However, I think as an addiction goes,
it's definitely worse. If you constantly remind yourself about the potential addiction, then you're on top of it almost. If you let it get out of hand, that's when it can spiral. But like I was saying to my brother and the other boys in Chamonix the other week, like, what we're doing is so weird. Like, most people would not enjoy this. Like, we're getting up at like 7 a.m. to go and do freaking 25K in the rain. Like, it is weird. No one enjoys that. But that's where the addiction thing comes in. And that's what we love. And like, right now, my legs are killing me, but I would love to go run up an Alp again. So it is strange.
Yeah, it's an addiction. It's an addiction. And, it's just socially deemed acceptable to be addicted to exercise. And like you said, I don't think there's too much wrong with that. talk us through then your disciplined daily routine then. Where does it begin? And just walk us through the things that you do habitually.
Begins usually the night before, and I'll plan out what my session's going to be in the morning. I'll get various bits of kit out that I know I'm going to put on, do that. I tend to get to bed at sort of 10-ish, maybe a bit earlier, sort of 9:45. Try and get up a good sort of 5, 4:30, go and smash out an hour or two of whatever, and then sort of have some breakfast, get into work. And I can do most of what sort of get everything done, not everything done, but get a good chunk of my day done by like 9, 10 a.m. and can just be so productive. And if I get that first few hours of the day right, everything's just set up. So yeah, I'll get a planned session in that I've done the night before, have some food, do some work. And then from there on, I'll probably train again at like maybe lunch or in the afternoon. Not so much now, but as I ramp up towards Ironman next year, I'll do 2 sessions a day again. I did that a lot last year. That's again with the obsession thing. It's weird. I just enjoy training. So yeah, most of it is all just in the morning, really. The first sort of 5 a.m. to 10, 11. That's what really sets me up.
So here's a question for you then. It sounds like a good portion of your day is dedicated to eating, resting and training.
Yeah.
Fine. If a business took off and required more time from you, would you be able to give it up and dedicate yourself to the business? And the second part of that question is, would you want to? Or would you rather keep it smooth and have the lifestyle?
I would sacrifice for that priority. But for me, I'll do exercise like I'll breathe. Like I have to do it. It's just normal. So if that means if business, say, picked up and I had to do those, I'd just get up an hour earlier and do a bit more. So I would sacrifice and I'd measure up priorities. I'd probably scale exercise back. If business was really that busy, I'd scale things back, but I would still train. Like I feel so much better mentally, physically, if I train. So I know the value and the benefit of it. So giving it up fully, if business was busy, wouldn't make sense to me. But also with doing an Ironman next year, I'm going to have to train a lot and do some big hours. So, and I've already sort of mentally, well, I knew that anyway. I knew that's going to happen. So yeah, I would give it up, but I definitely wouldn't stop fully.
So one other question then, why haven't you become someone that sells a fitness plan or is a trainer or something like that? That's something more aligned with your passion. Why have you stuck with e-commerce the second time around? Cause you've done it once, built something up and then you're looking to do it again. So I'm just interested to understand why you're looking to do it again.
Well, I was tempted and actually still am tempted to do fitness training currently. There's something that is still holding me back with it that I'm not really sure what it is, but it has crossed my mind. Maybe it's something to do with turning your passion into work. Maybe. I don't know. Two years ago, I dropped a load of weight. I went from sort of 113 kilos down to about 102, and I wrote up a guide of everything I did, everything I sort of used, tips and tricks. I've sold that on, I think it was on Gumroad. Have you ever used Gumroad before?
I haven't even heard of it. Or I have heard of it, but I might be getting confused with Silk Road, which I think is a dark web thing.
No, it wasn't that. No, it's basically a website you can just sell like guides on or like ebooks, that sort of stuff.
Right.
So I wrote all that up and I was selling that. I think I've sold a handful of copies for 25 quid each because I know there's a lot of value in it and people want to lose weight. I can help them. So I thought about doing it, but yeah, I might do it down the line, to be honest. I might do it.
Yeah. Mixing pleasure and passion is always difficult. I think that's a realization that I've had with a podcast, for example. You know, started out of just love and I continue to do it for that reason, but it's a lot of work. And you just sometimes you think, you know, you could have just kept this a passion, but I, at the end of the day, love doing it. So all good. Go on.
I was just going to say, I think you have to keep thinking long term and keep reminding yourself why you're doing something And if on the day you're having a bit of a, why am I doing this kind of thing, or I wish I didn't do this, or that sort of thing, if you just remind yourself long term why you're doing something, it usually then makes sense again.
Yeah, that's absolutely, I think that's right. So bit of advice then for an entrepreneur that perhaps doesn't engage in much exercise or self, I can't think of the word, but looking after themselves, you know, maybe in a mental way or a physical way, what would your advice be as a kind of lifelong athlete and someone that takes exercise pretty seriously? If someone's listening to this and going, yeah, but I can't be bothered, you know, how could they get started, do you think? What could they do tomorrow or the day after that could just get them going on possibly a path to being like a habitual exerciser?
Just get out and move. Like, you don't need to go and do crazy stuff like running up mountains. You just don't need to do that. Just go out and move. Like, I say this to friends as well currently who they ask me about running and all this sort of stuff. And I just say to them, just go out and move. Like, just go and do 20 minutes of, whether it's 10 minutes walk, 10 minutes run, just go and move. And all exercise is better than no exercise. You're always going to feel better after. You're always going to be fitter. You're going to feel mentally clearer. There's no downside to it. So just go and move, essentially. That's what I say. Like, the more you look after yourself, the more longevity you've got, the better you'll feel in the day, the better your work will be, the better you'll be a better wife, husband, whatever. There's no downside, basically.
And how about nutrition? What would you say for your kind of nutrition guide?
Same thing with that, is the more you look after yourself, the better you will feel. And it's really, I say it's really simple to eat well, but society doesn't tell us what to eat. That's also one reason why I potentially would like to help people, because it's quite simple in my mind. Just eat a high protein diet, get your fruits and veggies in, drink water all day. And if you stick to those few things, get a good night's sleep, you'll feel pretty fresh, and limit alcohol.
Sleep's a big one. Sleep's a big one, isn't it, for people? You've got to get more sleep, people. 7-8 hours, just try and get it in there. It's no real excuse. You can go to bed at 8 p.m.
People don't realize how beneficial sleep is. And they'll wake up and think, oh, I feel terrible today. I wonder why. Like, you've had 4 hours sleep, you know.
I wore a Whoop strap for 18 months, 2 years. And
how'd you find it?
It was good. I mean, the reason why I chucked it in the end and I did really enjoy it was actually more of a functional thing than it was the actual product. It was because I kept the charger slots that came with it. I had the very first Whoop, and I think it was a version 3 that came out. The chargers that slid over the top, great initiative, so you never have to take it off, brilliant. But if you break or lose those chargers or forget to charge them, which is, I did all of those things, at the time they had a pretty big shortage on those chargers, and most of the stock was going to the US. So there was like 4 week wait times on these chargers. So you've got a Whoop on, you don't want to break your streak. You have literally got one of the metrics is your streak, your daily streak of wearing it, but you can't charge it. So, and then you place your order for a 30 quid piece of plastic that's going to arrive in 4 weeks. So you have to take the Whoop off for 4 weeks. You're still paying for the subscription, and it just became a complete mess. I imagine they sorted it now because the churn must have been huge, and they probably knew it was a problem but didn't have the resources to fix it. But ultimately the Apple Watch came along and got a lot better, so I switched to an Apple Watch. Would I switch back to a Whoop now? I like the sleep element of it the most, but to be honest, it didn't affect my behavior that much. I already didn't drink, I already got pretty good sleep, and I was already training quite well or within my abilities, so it told me things but didn't necessarily affect how I changed. And I think I was probably in that 10% of people that are kind of pretty healthy.
I think there's I'm on the fence with all these sort of wearable health things, because I think a lot of people become reliant on it. And if you wake up and think, oh, my phone is telling me I've had a bad night's sleep, then in their head, they're like, I've had a bad night's sleep, and they might actually feel all right. So I think people rely on it a bit too much and listen to their phone rather than listening to what their body's actually telling them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the people that stand to gain the most are the people that have a semi unhealthy lifestyle. They're not a terribly unhealthy lifestyle, because if you have a terribly unhealthy lifestyle, the chances are you probably know you have an unhealthy lifestyle, but you continue to do it anyway for one reason or another. I think it's those people in the mid ground who perhaps are an entrepreneur and they have a whiskey of an evening after a stressful day, or a glass of wine or two. And maybe get 5 hours sleep, not 7 or 8. And it will hold up a mirror to them and show them how shocking that is for your body. Even though they might have done it for years and be very used to it, it will give you the data and it will be red. And that's enough, I think, to spark some change. But I think for the majority of healthy people, it's kind of just confirmation bias. You're doing kind of okay, or most of the time. Yeah. And would you pay?
I use my Garmin. I use my Garmin watch, and that hooks up to an app as well. And it's fairly basic. It's just like your how good your sleep is, what your sort of body battery is. And I love all that data, more so just because I'm a bit of a nerd and it's interesting. And like last week in Chamonix, my body battery was like nothing, dead the whole week. So it is interesting to see numbers and sort of compare it.
There's always a certain amount of skepticism I have as well with these devices. It's almost like a sci-fi non-belief. It's like, how can something that is sat on my wrist and that ultimately has some light shining into my veins, how can this tell me, like, well, especially when it's like how deeply you slept and different moments of your sleep? I'm like, how? Based on what measurements are you taking?
I think you've got to take it all with a pinch of salt. It's all with a pinch of salt, isn't it? Sometimes I've used it and my body battery has said something totally different to what I feel like. So then I'm like, pinch of salt again. But last week in Chamonix, it was saying it was very low and I felt knackered. So I was like, okay, it's probably fairly accurate this now.
Well, I also think there's an element of oversimplicity in this, which is ultimately, if you think back to when we were wild animals on the Saharan plains, I don't know if I was ever a wild animal on the Saharan plains, but you know, ultimately, when your body was in its worst condition, i.e. you haven't eaten for a long time, you haven't slept maybe so well, think of a lion maybe, that's when your body needs to perform, because you then need to go and catch that next meal. And I've also felt that myself in a sort of other way, where I felt like crap and then I've hit the gym or I've hit a workout and I've like smashed it beyond all belief. And I'm just, wow, afterwards feel great and I've had a great workout. And I know even the Nike founder, Phil Knight, he wrote in his book about when he was running, his coach would often not allow them to eat before races. They'd go into the races hungry because supposedly he believed that that made them better runners. Their body was more prepped to run because they
needed to catch them. I agree on that. Yeah, I agree on that. And I think this often. It's a weird thought. I mean, most people won't think it, but I always think back as well to, like, what would my caveman me be doing? Like, he might have eaten like a little fish, or he might have caught a, you know, little rabbit, or got a bunch of nuts or whatever. And in our society now, we're programmed to have breakfast, lunch, dinner. And that's totally like not natural. And again, what you were saying is it's amazing what the body can do when it's knackered, because that's when it's more alert. Like, I've done intermittent fasting quite a bit. And it's amazing how alert you feel when you're hungry, because you're essentially in hunting mode. Like, you need to find food. And I feel mentally clearer. I just keep chugging the water. I agree on that. If you can go and do a session and bust out a good session whilst you're sort of hungry, that again builds into the whole, you're fighting through tough times and you come out stronger.
Yeah, I think we're in a semi-dangerous place at the moment in the world with oversimplification in a lot of different areas, not just health and fitness, but just in everything, really. And I think you have to just do everything within your power to find what is right for you and pursue that. But also very into the wearables. I do want to see what happens next, where we go from here with the wearable technology, especially in sports. I've seen that there's some companies, there's one company called Energy or something like that. They're doing a lot in the kind of battery health space, fitting all these bits of equipment with batteries. And the idea being is that you do your workout in the morning and then that battery that you create, generate using your muscles in that workout. That powers your desk for the day. So you take it off that piece of equipment you plug it into the next piece, and then you slam it on your desk and plug all your bits into it, and that will power you for the day. So people like you can crank out a workout.
Interesting to see where all this goes, isn't it? Especially with AI and everything crazy coming in with AI and what's possible. But that was one thing you just said there. That was also kind of why I do this active disciplined life, is because everything now is so easy. I kind of feel like I need to do something difficult each day, because it's so easy just to sit there and, you know, you can ring up and have food delivered. You can work from home. You don't have to do anything anymore. So I'm like, I need to do something hard. Otherwise I'll just fall into, you know, a sloth position.
Yeah, well, it's a search for meaning, isn't it, ultimately? And you've placed a high significance on exercise, and that brings you meaning. Someone else might do socializing, someone else might do work, and someone else might do something else. But I think, it's weird. Yeah. We're at a time where religion, I mean, last century, maybe up until just before the end of the last century, religion was kind of the most meaning for most people. That has been replaced by science. So you can easily fall into nihilism if you're not careful. So I think people are searching for some meaning, but
we're definitely searching for meaning now. I think we're on a tipping point in the globe where there's a big sort of shift happening, and people not trusting governments and authorities and looking for something else. And it'll be interesting to see where everything goes, really.
It will. And I fundamentally, one of the things I believe is that, like you said, governments aren't going to play a particularly big role in providing that meaning to the masses. And I don't think people as individuals are very good at choosing their own path. There are some strong individuals like you who choose healthier addictions, like we've spoken about. And I think it's going to come down to businesses, and in a kind of free market capitalism type of way. Yeah. Hopefully there's enough of these good businesses that can kind of create meaning in people's lives. But I do think it will become a bit factional, and you'll see like we've seen this uprising of these run club kind of accessory and apparel brands. Gives people meaning, you know, they belong to that club, and it's more than just a product to them. And I think we're
people
starting
are always to looking for something.
Yeah, without doubt. Right, quick fire round to round this all off. If you could be CEO of the day of any business, which business would you be CEO of?
That's a good question. Probably something like Nike or Adidas. Just such a huge, well-established company that seems to have pretty good values in an interesting sector. Probably something like that. I mean, in terms of a power and monopoly, you'd say something like Facebook or something, but tech's not my bag.
You have a dinner reservation with someone alive or past, anyone. Who would you sit opposite at the dinner table for a night?
That's a very good question. Don't know, maybe like Genghis Khan or something, like someone like totally mental. I don't know. I need to think on that. That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. What was the last thing you purchased online from a D2C brand and or Amazon?
I think it was my trail shoes that I bought the other week. I bought a pair of those Brooks running shoes, and I had an old pair of trail shoes and they were a bit old. So I was like, buy a new pair. I think it was a pair of shoes, and I didn't wear them at all until we got to Chamonix and then did 65K in them, and they survived. So yeah, I think a pair of shoes.
Yeah. You're a classic guy then, going with the Brooks over some of these more.
I'm such a cheapskate, honestly. I don't spend any money.
Why is that?
Do you know what it is? It's after running Slide Tribe, the slider business, I became so exposed to the actual prices of things, the manufacturer price. So I see like a t-shirt that costs like £4, and I go see a company, take your like Satisfy Running or whatever, and they're charging like 50, 60 quid for a t-shirt. And then me being a stubborn founder who's seen what the real costs, I'm like, I can't spend that. I'm not spending that, because I know the true cost. And I know there's like obviously all the extra overheads bundled up in there for the t-shirt. But yeah, just a massive cheapskate, typical bloke, really.
No, I completely understand it. I'd sooner start a brand myself and order the MOQ of that brand and wear it for the rest of my life than overpay for a...
My brother the other week, he bought like 10 t-shirts for about 20 quid or something. And he was like, yeah, that'll do me for about 10 years.
There you go. That's the smart way to do it. Where can people find you and where can they order a trail map, a run map, if they want one?
Active on Twitter. I think it's just Tom Hassan. I don't even know what my Twitter name is. Hang on. Tom Hassan with three S's. Tom Hassan 1. Active on Twitter. Tom Hassan on Instagram. On LinkedIn as well, but LinkedIn's a bit of a weird one. Twitter, Instagram.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much for joining us on the Ecom Girl podcast. And people reach out to Tom if you have any questions. All right, that was Tom. Everybody, we got a bit deep there at the end. If you've made it this far, thanks for sticking around. It's always nice to get a full spectrum of e-commerce founders and operators on the show, not just the sort of 8 and 9 figure guys and gals, but also some of the startups and people that are just, you know, using e-commerce to make some money and try some ideas. And I love that. So thanks again for sticking around. Episode brought to you by Sendlane and Rewind. And we'll be back next week for another episode of the Ecom Gold podcast. See you there.